You're listening to the Liberty News Radio Network, and this is the Political Cesspool. The Political Cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program, and here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Some of you high church boys may not know some of these old Southern gospel hymns, but I probably sang that song 1,000 times growing up, and it's Easter weekend, and we're playing it tonight, Keith Alexander.
Well, I've heard it enough. I may not have sung it in church enough, but...
Heard enough on this show over the last 20 years on Easter, but hey, I got to ask you before we continue tonight, March Around the World, we're wrapping up, which I think, and I told you this earlier tonight, it was the best installment, even after all these years. We've been doing it about 4 or 5 years now.
It had an energy this year.
Dries Van Langenhove and Jim Dowson in the first hour, to have both of them at 30 minutes apiece, you could have gone easily an hour with both, and both of them sold the show.
I mean, they're both. Everybody's been electric so far this year. There's been low energy people on this. March Around the World March that we've had. And I'm sure that Taylor, our next guest, is going to keep that tradition going here.
Well, I'll tell you what, in a way, we started March Around the World with Antelope Hill Publishing. Paul Kersey was on representing a couple of his books that they have republished at antelopehillpublishing.com. And now Taylor Young, all the guests we've had on. So here we are now at the very end of March. There has not been one guest that we've featured this year that has appeared twice so far this year until now. Taylor Young is the first guest to make an encore appearance this year from Antelope Hill Publishing. And Taylor, it's great to have you back tonight. Happy Easter. How are you?
Hello, I'm doing great. Thank you guys, as always, for having me on. And I hope I live up to all the expectations.
I have no doubt. Now, people will be saying, well, you're an American, so what are you doing on this month? Well, Spain is one of the nations we have not visited in any of our March Around the World installments, and Antelope Hill Publishing has not one or two, but three books on Spanish history that I think you're going to want to check out, and that is why.
I think that Spanish history is neglected. I think that it doesn't get the attention it deserves.
Exactly. Well, listen, this is what we're going to talk about this first segment before we get into some of these titles. I mean, needless to say, Spain holds an important place in the history of Western civilization. I mean, what with all the business of 14...
Well, basically, most of the landmass was colonized by the Spanish.
1492 and all of that. It's both awe-inspiring and nearly unbelievable, gentlemen. Let me say this, to think at how fast we, our people, whites, moved once Columbus set sail and officially kicked off the age of exploration. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm also fascinated by the Viking Age. We had Henrik Palmgren on last week representing Sweden, the Viking Age from 800 to 1000 AD, and they did make it all the way to North America. But in terms of making the presence permanent, I mean, consider this. It starts in Spain with Columbus and Isabella, for whom my oldest daughter is named after. By 1519, Cortes is face-to-face with Montezuma in Tenochtitlan. And with 600 men and a burn-the-boats resolve, the conquistadors toppled an empire of 5 million people in 2 years.
They didn't just burn bridges, they burned boats.
I mean, what? By 1572, the Spanish are all the way down to modern-day Peru and Chile. And around this time, of course, too, the French and the English are following suit. They're beginning to establish colonies. By 1585, we're in Roanoke, 1607, Jamestown, 1620, Plymouth Rock, and we are on our way and here to stay. And that era of European history all started in Spain, And while that period isn't exactly what Taylor Young is back with us to talk about this evening, I can't help but swell with a little bit of pride, I got to say, when I think about what our people are capable of when properly motivated and with a little bit of wind in their sails. Taylor, would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's actually a great introduction to this book, to the first book that I think we want to talk about, which is Speech to the Youth in Spain by perhaps one of the lesser known but no less deserving fathers of Spanish fascism, who was Ramiro Ledesma Ramos. And he actually also begins the book by an overview of Spanish history, starting pretty much right where you did, or like right after the Reconquista, or after the Reconquista, which he identifies as like a period over which Spain was gradually unified, and then it really that unification really came to fruition in the Spanish Empire and Spain's golden age, which in his view lasted for about 100 years. Spain gradually became in decline, and the way he puts it is ultimately, you know, it's not just a decline, but it was a defeat. It was defeated ultimately by the French and the English, and their empires. Then there's a period of stagnation, politically speaking, in which basically he identifies two currents that are going to continue throughout Spanish history. You have kind of a more reactionary Catholic, sometimes pro-monarchist force that basically just is trying to kind of restore the glory days, but it kind of quickly loses connection with the historical development that Spain undergoes. And then on the other side, you have basically the birth of what becomes an anarchist leftist movement in Spain, which is just trying to kind of, he describes it as ultimately very, very lacking in energy, and just kind of trying to wait until things kind of collapse. So, but the reason that I bring it up is because it goes directly into the period before the Spanish Civil War and the rise of Spanish fascism. So after that, Spain goes through the period of the restoration of the monarchy, then there's a short dictatorship, and then we end up with the Second Spanish Republic, which is the one that is governing Spain at the outbreak of the Civil War. And what he points to is that this Second Spanish Republic, it came into power basically because of how exhausted every other attempt at governing Spain had become by that point. The Restoration monarchy failed. The military dictatorship also failed ultimately to inspire a national unity in Spain. So it all just kind of collapses under its own weight, and the Republic is, in his words, it's not any kind of, it doesn't rise by virtue of its own merit or anything, or even necessarily by a popular will or a popular demand. It's just that these are the people to whom it, basically the government is reduced to and it's left to. And so that's how you get the Second Spanish Republic, which, you know, basically, then you have the rise of the Falange and the Spanish fascist and national socialist movements that are trying to, as Ledesma and as Primo de Rivera, whose book, one of his books we also have, basically they're trying to finally like dig Spain out of this like centuries of decline where they're just choosing between, you know, the constant lesser of two evils, and create a true nationalist and national idea for Spain. I'll let you jump back in with that, but I just thought that was a really good segue into, because that is something that the book itself discusses, and so you see how it connects directly into the Spanish Civil War, into the unpopularity of the Second Republic, and into the rise of Spanish fascism.
Taylor, this is Keith Alexander. I think my idea about why the Spanish-speaking parts of North America did not become white nations where the English-speaking parts did, the idea that I drew was that the Spaniards, unlike the English and the Dutch and even the French, weren't so interested in colonizing. They were interested in making a hat full of money, going home and enjoying it back in good old Spain. I have the feeling that's not really the whole story. What is the story on that? Why, for example, you know, none of these Spanish colonies are really white nations, but the white nations were the ones that were English colonies for the most part.
Well, I think that there would probably be some truth to that. I think you're right that it's probably kind of overblown in as a total explanation. But you definitely saw each of the colonial powers, the Spanish, the French, the English, they all had a kind of a different approach to their colonies. And as we kind of see in hindsight, ultimately, it was the English ones that led to like the most cohesive and racially cohesive white nations over the long run. So the Spanish Empire, there was definitely a large part of it where it became very, very wealthy through the gold and everything it found in the New World. And it was partly about that, but it was partly as well just kind of ultimately a result of it of being defeated by the English and the French.
We'll take a quick break. Mainstream publishers are too afraid to touch, providing you with information you need to challenge the status quo. Whether your interests include contemporary dissident politics, history that would otherwise be censored or slandered, philosophy, or exciting and thought-provoking fiction, you'll find plenty to love in the Antelope Hill catalog, which includes books such as Generation 68, The Elite Revolution and Its Legacy, about the elite-driven cultural revolution of the 1960s, which transformed America. Whitey on the Moon, about the demise of the space program due to diversity. The Sword of Christ, which argues for restoring Christianity as the foundation of the West and combating heresies like Christian Zionism. Speeches by Mussolini and other historical figures, and much more. With new titles added every month, there's no doubt that they have something for everyone. So check out their catalog today at antelopehillpublishing.com.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at cspoa.org. That's cspoa.org.
Standing on the promises I cannot fall, listening every moment to the Spirit's call, resting in my Savior as my all in all, standing on the promises of God.
Fully am aware of the fact that here on this Easter weekend, we have people of all different denominations. In the South, that is how we do Easter. And I remember a friend during the Buchanan campaign who was a Catholic. And we have people of all different denominations, Catholics, Orthodox, pagans, atheists, agnostics, you name it, tuned in tonight, and we love you all.
Congregationalists.
We love you. Well, that's a different kind of congregationalist than they have down at Memphis, the First Congo.
Right.
But a Catholic friend of mine said that he lived in Milan, Tennessee, this small little town north of Jackson, and he said that the Catholic Church there was more like a mission that you would do it because it's just – anyway, happy Easter wherever you are. and whatever denomination you belong this Easter weekend. Back with Taylor Young. And we're talking about three titles related to Spanish history that are available at antelopehillpublishing.com. He was talking in the previous segment about the speech to the Spanish youth. I want to read just very quickly a little bit from the back cover. Fascism in its various iterations swept through continental Europe like a tidal wave in the 1920s and 30s. When Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy tend to steal the show in historical examinations of the topic, Spain was also one of the most fruitful strongholds. And Taylor was telling you a little bit more about Ramiro Lezima Ramos, who was born in Spain at the beginning of the 20th century, made a name for himself as one of the most fervent pioneers of fascism in his country. He has an interesting background. You can find out more by going to antelopehillpublishing.com. We are fast-forwarding through Spanish history from the late 1400s to the early 1920s here. But I would ask you just very quickly to sum up your segment on this book, Taylor. In your opinion, in what ways was he able to transmit the seeds of his ideas to the youth in a way that ultimately bore fruit and flourished in Spain? And why was Central and Southern Europe such fertile ground for fascism in the 1920s and 30s?
Well, there's no question that he was one of the pioneers of the Spanish national fascist, or honestly, more accurately, probably you can compare it to a national socialist movement, which became the Falange, and then ultimately the Falange was kind of the name and the branding, and some of the ideas were taken on by Franco's government after the war. Ledesma was absolutely one of the fathers of that movement. In fact, he actually designed the yoke and arrows symbol. He also coined the mottos that ultimately come into use in Francoist Spain. Certainly the most prominent, individual in the Falangist Spanish National Socialist movement was José Antonio Primo de Rivera, the two of them had a falling out at some point, Ledesma eventually left the Falange organization. They both died in 1936, which was after the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War. So they were both basically captured by the Republicans, and they were both executed. But in any case, their ideas are very similar in most ways. And like I said, it is very comparable ultimately to a kind of a national socialism. This book, Speech to the Youth of Spain, he basically says that there are two ideas that Spain needs to rebuild itself, basically to rebuild its glory, and that is the national idea, Spain as a historic unified entity, Spain as the fatherland of the Spanish people, and secondly the social idea, or the socialist economics, which ultimately is something that in the Falangist interpretation differed from Marxism, in that it wasn't about class struggle or dictatorship of the proletariat, but they did identify that the working class, needed to have more of a part of the social order and the social contract. So, he talks in the book about how the whole of Europe during this time is looking for some kind of, he calls them subversive forces, which kind of has a negative connotation, but it's not really the intended meaning. The intended meaning is that Europe is looking for revolutionary forces that can kind of lead it forward and propel it into a new stage, because especially places like Spain that had been languishing so long and had been economically deprived so long, something that would overcome the exploitive bourgeois capitalism, the answer that he and others came up with was the national syndicalism or national socialism that I was describing. So,
Taylor, this is Keith Alexander. Let me chime in here for just a moment. We need to remember that people like Franco and the others that were aligned with him, Mussolini, Hitler, they were grassroots anti-communists. The communists were not happy just to have Russia. They wanted to take over all of Europe. And you had these patriot groups crop up. Hitler came to the head of the class in Germany, Mussolini in Italy, Franco in Spain. And out of the three of them, the great success story is Franco, because he declined.
He didn't lose power after 1945.
Well, he died in bed in the mid-70s, and that didn't win the fate for either Mussolini or Hitler. And quite frankly, I think Germany would have been better off if Mussolini had followed Franco's pattern and basically stayed out and said, we're going to be a neutral in this. Neither side can use our land as a staging ground. I think that one of the things that caused Hitler's loss to the Russians in the Russian front was he had so many troops nailed down on the Italian peninsula trying to defend Mussolini, whose army proved to be totally inept.
I think I don't know if it was a cliche or if he actually said it or if this is what people have inferred, but I think Hitler was praying for deliverance from his allies.
the joke used to be, what's the thinnest book written in history? And that's the Compendium of Italian War Heroes.
Well, now, you know, going back into European history, that's a different story with Rome and all of that. But anyway, I want to say this very quickly, Taylor, about this book, Anthology of Speeches and Quotes from Jose Antonio Primo de Rivera. Now, that's not a name that a lot of people are going to know, even the learned folks tuned into TPC tonight from Spanish history. This wasn't King Ferdinand and it wasn't Francisco Franco, but de Rivera was a Spanish lawyer, a parliamentarian, and a martyr. He was the son of General Miguel Primo de Rivera, the dictator of Spain from 1923 to 1930. This is from the back of the book at antelopehillpublishing.com. Rivera founded a Falange Española, the Spanish phalanx, in 1933. Grew slowly at first, winning just 0.7% of the vote, or 0.07, I should say, of the vote, in 1936 February elections, but it swelled in numbers as tyranny and violence in the Second Spanish Republic grew. Jose Antonio Falange would later merge with other right-wing parties to form Spain's Pan-Nationalist Party, which would go on to hold power under Franco for nearly four decades. And that's what you were talking about, Keith, and we'll revisit that in the next segment. But Jose Antonio himself...
may have been the smart one out of the bunch.
Posthumously known as El Asante, the absent one, he became a revered figure among the Spanish right. I guess my last question for you about this book, this is Jose Antonio Primo de Rivera, An Anthology of Speeches and Quotes, would be, you know, Taylor, our side currently often fractures and purity spirals quite easily these days, which is an impediment to sustained success. What can we learn from the pan-nationalist breakthroughs in Spain at this time?
My first thought is that one of the lessons may be that the only way to get everybody together is for somebody to start a war. but hopefully it's not that bad. I mean, it does point to the necessity for unity and for cooperation, because, you know, ultimately even the whole Francoist side in the war was a coalition of different groups, you know, the military, monarchists, Falangists, you know, other groups that all came together.
A lot of people from North
Africa,
did they not?
Franco's army was from North Africa. I would assume that there would be some North African soldiers there for sure as well. So so it was, you know, it was a coalition of different groups that ultimately, you know, believed in a better Spain than the one that was handed down to the Second Republic. Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is a lesson for us in that as well, and you know, hopefully we can get it together before there's a war.
Before we exit stage left of history.
No, we go the way of Hitler and Mussolini.
I think we will. Hope springs, and I think we're going to turn this thing around. There's so many reasons I believe that. I've given speeches on it, my Amarin speech, Countercurrents, but Taylor, we are talking about Spain, such an important nation in the history of Western civilization, of white civilization. The music's playing. We are talking about a collection of three books available at antelopehillpublishing.com. We've covered two already. Remind us the titles at antelopehillpublishing.com, Taylor, very quickly if you can.
Pro
proclaiming liberty across the land. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News, I'm Laura Winters. The White House says President Biden will be visiting the site of the Baltimore Bridge collapse next week. The Navy bringing in big cranes on barges to assist workers in lifting the remains of the mangled bridge from the water. Here is Maryland Governor Democrat Wes Moore.
To see a freight that is nearly the size of the Eiffel Tower, and to see that same freight with the Key Bridge resting on top of it, to see shipping containers that were ripped in half as if they were paper mache.
And there are plans for a memorial plaque to remember the six men killed in the collapse. Here's USA's John Schaefer.
Brawner Builders Executive Vice President Jeffrey Pritzker has sent a letter to Maryland Governor Wes Moore requesting that a memorial plaque with the names of the victims be placed at the entrance of the new bridge once it's built.
To the families, to the spouses, to the children, to see the names up there, see their family, their loved ones memorialized, I think it would be a wonderful thing. And you never bring anybody back, but at least you can preserve the memory in that fashion.
Six employees of the Cockeysville, Maryland company were on the bridge when it was hit by a cargo vessel and collapsed on Tuesday.
In USA News for your health, the CDC reporting the first human case of swine flu in the U.S. this year. Doctors think a child in Pennsylvania caught the virus after being in contact with pigs. Occasionally, this infection can jump to humans. Prayers in Hebrew at the funeral service for former Senator Joe Lieberman in his hometown of Stamford, Connecticut. Lieberman, the first Jewish vice presidential candidate back in 2000, on the ticket with Al Gore, the former vice president, at the service Friday. Lieberman passing away from complications after falling. He was 82 years old. And I'm Laura Winters, USA News.
I've got a unique vacation idea for you that's right here in the United States. If you're ready for a vacation that's fun and downright affordable, listen up. It's driving distance for many of you, so no planes, no airline delays, no hassles. It's Branson, Missouri, the entertainment capital of the Midwest. Live music for everyone. Branson has three beautiful, enormous lakes, water attractions, live shows, great food, and tons of entertainment. It's a perfect vacation for you and your family, or if you're retired and you want to have a great time. And you can stay in Branson for as low as $99 a night. Please understand, this is not a timeshare offer. It's a real vacation for as little as $99 a night. We've got a free vacation guide we want to send you right now. All you have to do is call for complete details. Get your free Branson, Missouri guide right now by calling this number.
800-399-4215. 800-399-4215. 800-399-4215. That's 800-399-4215.
Hey there, TPC family. This is James Edwards, your host of The Political Cesspool. Folks, I want you to subscribe to the American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. Against all odds, AFP has and continues to publish a populist, independent print newspaper with an unparalleled track record. Founded by a dedicated group of experienced patriots, AFP pulls no punches and tackles the most controversial and pressing issues facing America from an America First perspective. I've worked with the American Free Press since even before the beginning of TPC. Now that's something. You can subscribe to the print edition by visiting AmericanFreePress.net today or simply pick up a handy digital edition subscription. However you do it, subscribe to the American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, by visiting AmericanFreePress.net or by calling 1-888-699-NEWS, AmericanFreePress.net.
Hello, TPC family. It's James, and I've got to tell you that I sleep better at night knowing that there are organizations like the Conservative Citizens Foundation. The purpose of the Conservative Citizens Foundation is to promote the principles of limited government, individual liberty, equality before the law, property rights, law and order, judicial restraint, and states' rights, while at the same time exploring the dangers posed by liberalism to our national interests and cultural institutions. The Conservative Citizens Foundation also seeks to educate educate the public on the dangers of extremist ideologies like critical race theory and cultural Marxism. I've worked with the good people at the Conservative Citizens Foundation for many years, and their work comes with my complete endorsement. For more information and to keep up with all the latest conservative news headlines, please check out their website, AmericaFirst.com. That's MERICA1ST.com. AmericaFirst.com.
Forget, ladies and gentlemen, still coming up in the third and final hour tonight as our march around the world draws to a close, we'll hear from Pastor Brett McAtee. He is the pastor of Christ the King Reformed Church in Charlotte, Michigan, and he's going to tell us the Easter message, the biblical account of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's in the third hour. Already tonight, live in Belgium, Dries Van Langenhove. Live in Northern Ireland, Jim Dowson. Now, Taylor Young from Antelope Hill Publishing, antelopehillpublishing.com. Spain has never been a featured nation in our march around the world, not because we don't think it's important. We think it's one of the most important nations in the history of Western civilization. But
and it's neglected, and that's why Antelope Hill is such a treasure to the world.
Well, you were complimenting Antelope Hill during the break.
These three books that they are publishing now, if it were not for Antelope Hill Publishing, who would publish
them? Well, I think that could be said about any of their titles.
Yeah,
but
basically, they come in and fill a void, and, you know, you'd have to be scouring ancient libraries otherwise, but Antelope Hill has brought these things to the forefront and made them easily accessible for people, and I think people who are serious students of history ought to really appreciate that.
And with only a couple of minutes remaining, Taylor, let's remind everybody, antelopehillpublishing.com, of course, the titles of the first two books we have been touching on this hour so far.
Yep, so that was Speech to the Youth of Spain by Ramiro Ledesma Ramos, and then Anthology of Speeches and Quotes by Jose Antonio Primo de Rivera, who are both foundational members of the Spanish Falangist movement.
And we will have
and
to
then
move.
What's number three?
I've got it right here for you, Keith. And this is, we'll have to move rapidly. Coming up later still, our final stop on March Around the World, a correspondent from Puerto Rico calling in from San Juan tonight. And he's going to really tie in, I think, this entire hour. This is his history, the history of Latin America, our final stop on March Around the World. But the final book we're profiling tonight from AntelopeHillPublishing.com is Spain, 1923 to 1948, Civil War and World War. And in this book, originally published in England in 1948, to add context to the conduct of Spain under Franco and during the Spanish Civil War, author Loveday targeted the British political consciousness with the chief aim of helping Spain's entry into the post-war NATO allied framework. And he depicts Franco as the unifying force behind a coalition of formerly left-leaning Falangists and monarchists. And he portrays Franco's reactionary Spain in a way that would appeal to Britain's desire for allies in the early years of what would become the Cold War. Loveday's work is a well-sourced and even-handed account of Spain's political and economic development in the early part of the 20th century. Spain, 1923 to 1948, Civil War and World War, is a necessary addition to the library of any scholar of mid-century European history. It's available for you right now at AntelopeHillPublishing.com. So when you think about Spain from 1923 to 1948, where do we begin, Taylor?
Well, we pretty much begin with period that we were talking about earlier with the Second Spanish Republic, which then resulted in the Spanish Civil War, which was, you know, as we've been talking about, was a very important conflict, not just for Spain, but for Europe, and important as an example in general. So, you know, so it is this book, the Spain Civil War and World War, is it's much longer than the other two. It's much more of a history book. So the other two are much more ideological. They're you know, about philosophy and laying out what is Spanish national syndicalism and how it relates to Spain's history and Spain's condition. And this one, like you were reading, is written by, I think, a British journalist, contemporary of the period, and basically goes through some of the crises that occurred, precipitated the Spanish Civil War, and then through the Civil War and into World War II. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, with regard to World War II, we have sort of glossed over Franco. Franco had a military background. He was a general who led the nationalist forces in overthrowing the Second Spanish Republic during the Spanish Civil
War. Which was a bunch of bad leftists, for the most part, okay? Like the Abraham Lincoln Brigade from a bunch of communists from America and elsewhere.
All right, but he rose to power in 1939. Now, 1939 was a pretty big year in European history. Let's very quickly, what do we like about Franco?
We like the fact that, one, he was a right winger; two, that he was a person that put Spain first. He was not sold out to international communism like his opponents were, and three, he had enough foresight and wisdom to take a pass on getting involved in World War II, and that was a great boon both to him and to the Spanish people.
Well, that's the thing, right, Taylor? I mean, Spain was nominally neutral during World War II. It was even though they're described as far right and nationalist and fascist, they were, you know, ideologically allied with Germany and Italy, but they didn't actually join the war. They collaborated, but they didn't join the war. You didn't see any conquistadors or Spanish troops at D-Day or the Battle of the Bulge or anywhere in between. So I guess, you know, but why? I mean, I don't know if that would have turned the tide in the whole thing, but
It would have hurt Hitler even more, because both Italy and Spain had large coastlines which would have to be defended, and that was done basically with German troops. It wasn't Italy, and had Spain gotten into the war, it probably would have been the same thing with Spain.
All right, Taylor, you want to take a stab at that? I mean, unlike Hitler and Mussolini, he remained in power until the 1970s, as Keith mentioned.
I think that there's some truth to, I would agree definitely to what Keith is saying. I think that of all the kind of ideologically aligned powers at that time, Spain was probably the weakest and the least capable at that point. It had just gone through the whole civil war. It had been very underdeveloped in the decades, even the centuries prior. So I think you could make a good argument that it wouldn't have contributed very significantly, and may even have been a detriment to the overall Axis war effort, which is very unfortunate, but, you know, I think you can definitely make that argument. It's not quite true that there weren't Spanish troops that participated, however. There wasn't any kind of official military support, but especially of the most ideological Falangist fighters did volunteer, and they ended up as the somewhat famous Blue Division that fought against the Soviets in the East.
Great point.
So you did have that. I mean, it's altogether, it's a very complicated topic, but I think you can even see you read from the description of the Love Day book that the Falange was, you know, it was the official ruling party under Franco, but it wasn't quite the same as the Falange that kind of made its attempt to creating Spain in its own image before the Civil War. And ultimately there was this attempt, probably certainly by the Spanish and by Franco, to kind of paint themselves in this anti-communist light, which they certainly were, and they did defeat communism in Spain, which was a tremendous accomplishment. But I think what I'm trying to say is that ultimately, to the Allied post-war order was not really ultimately friendly to Franco, and they
Taylor,
they,
No, I appreciate that. And these books are available. Also, a book on Mussolini's speeches. That's Italy's another spot we haven't yet touched down in, a march around the world. All the nations we've visited over these years. But that's there as well. But you had something, and I want to circle back to this just seconds before the music begins. There's a section of the book we made mention of, Jose Antonio's book, his last will, that he mentions his Christian faith. You're saying, well, what does all this fascist European history stuff have to do with Easter and the Christian faith? Maybe you can tie it together and fit it in with the Easter season right now.
Yep, certainly. So I'll just read this as quickly as I can. It's the first page of his will, which he wrote after he was condemned to be executed, which just it always has struck me as a tremendous example of the personal faith that he must have had to be able to write something like this at the time that he's knowing he goes to his death. So, condemned yesterday to death, I pray God that if he does not still spare me from coming to that last trial, he may preserve in me up to the end the seemly submission with which I contemplate it, and that in judging my soul he may apply to it not the measure of my merits, but that of his infinite mercy.
Amen to that. How about that to tie in European fascism with the Christian faith, Keith Alexander? Yeah, who could do it but Taylor Young?
That's right. I mean, you know, that is a Christian testimony, second to none.
Taylor, thank you so much. AntelopeHillPublishing.com. All of these titles we've been featuring tonight and showcasing tonight are available at your fingertips, AntelopeHillPublishing.com. Thank you, Taylor, and happy New
Year. Hey, friends, James Edwards here again to remind you that Antelope Hill Publishing is America's premier provider of dissident literature. They print books that mainstream publishers are too afraid to touch, providing you with information you need to challenge the status quo. Whether your interests include contemporary dissident politics, history that would otherwise be censored or slandered, philosophy, or exciting and thought-provoking fiction, you'll find plenty to love in the Antelope Hill catalog, which includes books such as Generation 68, The Elite Revolution and Its Legacy, about the elite-driven cultural revolution of the 1960s, which transformed America. Whitey on the Moon, about the demise of the space program due to diversity. The Sword of Christ, which argues for restoring Christianity as the foundation of the West and combating heresies like Christian Zionism. Speeches by Mussolini and other historical figures, and much more. With new titles added every month, there's no doubt that they have something for everyone. So check out their catalog today at AntelopeHillPublishing.com.
Attention collectors and savvy investors. We are excited to announce a momentous evolution in our journey. Introducing Free Water Coin Company, formerly known as Rust Coin and Gift. This rebranding takes us back to the very roots of where it all began, Free Water, Oregon. It's a tribute to the legacy of Al Rust and a celebration of three generations of dedication and excellence in the world of coins and precious gifts. Al, Brian, and Jake Rust, standing strong through 64 years of service. Discover a world of exceptional service at Free Water Coin Company, your premier destination for genuine, honest money and precious gifts. Under Brian's expert guidance, Free Water Coin Company, building on the legacy of Rust Coin and Gift, continues its tradition of trust and excellence. Visit us at our Provo, Utah location. Explore our treasures online at rustgoldandsilver.com or call us at 801-377-1574. Free Water Coin Company, where your future is built one honest coin at a time.
I have found a friend in Jesus. He's everything to me. He's the fairest of 10,000 to my soul. The lily of the valley, in him alone I see all I need to cleanse and make me fully whole. In sorrow he's my comfort, in trouble he's my stay. He tells me every care on him to roll. Stopped 10,000 to my soul.
He will never, never leave me, nor yet forsake me here, while I live by faith and do his blessed will. Oh, wall of fire about me, I've nothing now to fear. With this manna he my hungry soul shall fill.
Then sweeping up to glory, I'll see his blessed face, where rivers of delight shall ever roll.
He's the
lily of the valley, the bright and morning star.
He's the fairest of 10,000 to my soul.
Ladies and gentlemen, has this been a show or has this been a show tonight,
it's
Keith Alexander?
Been a great show. Inspirational in more ways than one.
Dries Van Langenhove in Belgium, Jim Dowson in Northern Ireland, and wasn't he fantastic for Easter? What a pick for an Easter guest.
I could listen to that voice forever.
Hey, I got to tell you, amen to that. And then Taylor Young. I mean, you were complimenting again Taylor Young during the break.
Taylor Young is a first-rate intellect. There's no doubt about it. Every time we have him on this show, he outdoes himself.
How about, did you think we could tie in fascism and Christianity? How about that? People say you can't do it. People, you know, the unlearned, the unintelligent. But yes, indeed, as Jim said, you can be a nationalist and you can be a Christian. We are Christians. We are nationalists, or we are nationalists, and we are Christians.
If you're a Christian, you should want Christians running your nation.
Well, in any event, Taylor Young, fantastic. What a fantastic series. And did you have it on your bingo card? Let me go through this again very quickly. I gotta do it one more time if you don't mind, ladies and gentlemen. One more time: Croatia, Canada, England, Brazil, Australia, Ireland, Germany, Sweden, Belgium, and Northern Ireland. There's a difference between Ireland and Northern Ireland, believe me.
And now we have come to Puerto Rico.
Did you think we'd hit Puerto Rico?
I never thought we would. So good, Bill, take it away.
Going
buddy.
To Bill in San Juan. And he is going to,
be glad you're not Haiti.
Oh, my gosh. Good evening.
Talking about Latin America, the Spanish imprint on Western civilization, this is your history, my friend. A longtime friend and supporter. He never misses a show. He's listened to more shows than you have, Keith. I can tell you that. And he's with us live. Take it away, Bill, without any further interruptions. If you can recreate the phone conversation we had today around lunchtime, we could not do better. The floor is yours.
Oh, my gosh. Well, let's do it this way. You know, you asked me to talk about Latin America and why is Latin America different than North America. I mean, the Spanish came a century before the English after Columbus discovered America in 1492. The first permanent Spanish settlement was at St. Augustine, Florida in 1519, way before Roanoke, which did not work out, did not succeed, or before Jamestown in 1607. Spain was the most powerful country in the world at that time. But there were a number of reasons why Latin America turned out differently, and we could talk about this all day. But for one thing, the Spanish did not create settler societies. The English did. The English generally brought women with them. They created families. They farmed. That was a big difference. So there were a lot fewer Spaniards going to Latin America. They were mostly sons of noblemen that came to make their fortune. Another important distinction was north of the Rio Grande, it's estimated there were less than a million Amerindians. So they were conquered over a period of time. They were conquered. They were assimilated. They eventually were put on reservations. South of the Rio Grande, they estimate there were 100 million Amerindians. Combined with the fact that the Spanish did not create settler societies, they intermarried with the local population. Some of the countries are more European, some of them aren't. But what holds it all together? And in Latin America, there is no distinct one-drop rule. It's more of a color continuum. Most New World Latins, including me, have mixed blood. It is what it is. What holds these societies together? They're very traditional cultures, the Catholic Church, the Spanish language, the Spanish culture. It is not a woke society. There is very little enthusiasm for LGBT or for feminism or whatever. There always have been Spanish people in the American Southwest from a very early time. What we are doing now, though, with the illegals and 7 million since 2021 and then how many getaways, It has upset the pot, and what happened before did not. But Latin America turned out different because their history was different, and who settled it, and the number of Amerindians there. It was just, and what they do to keep it together is their culture, and we don't have that here, and their model is not the model for us in the United States. So Puerto Rico's different. There's an American influence that's been there 120-something years now. But those are some of the reasons why Latin America is different. But that's what do you think about that, sir?
I think that's pretty good. The explanation I gave is that basically the English sent people over to settle. It may be because they were more snobbish than the Spanish. They wanted to get the riffraff out, but the riffraff turned out to have so much talent that they outdid the mother country, both all over the Anglosphere.
From Australia, which we've been to this
New
month,
Zealand,
the UK, the U.S., I mean.
On the other hand, the Spanish conquistadors, I think most of the people there came from the upper classes. They weren't trying to get rid of them in Spain. But they came over here so they could make a hat full and then go back to Spain.
I don't know about that.
Money.
I mean, Columbus obviously came to proselytize. I mean, they were coming to spread the faith. There's no doubt about that.
But what do you think about the idea that basically a lot of the conquistadors wanted to go back home with a hat full of money and enjoy themselves in Spain?
All right. But also, as you mentioned, they didn't bring women, so they did have to, I don't know if they had to, but they did interbreed because they were, what else are you going to do?
They figured that out in the West. Luckily, they didn't go the homosexual route.
But this is the legacy. This is the legacy, and it is the legacy of Latin America from Central America down to Puerto Rico and many of the island nations in the Caribbean. So back to you, Bill, in Puerto Rico.
Well, I mean, I think, Keith, you have a point. The conquistadors that came tended to be the younger sons that were not going to inherit the estate, and they wanted to make their own fortune in the Americas. Of course, some of those countries had vast wealth, such as, you know, Peru had silver. Mexico had vast wealth. Some of them did not. But the point is, from the early 1500s, within 50 years, they had colonized all of Latin America, what is now the American Southwest, except for Brazil. They had gone all the way from the American Southwest to Tierra del Fuego by Argentina and Chile. So that they were an amazing conquering people, and they have a great legacy. And yes, they did want to spread the faith. They wanted to spread the Catholic religion. And you understand that Columbus fell to America right after Ferdinand and Isabella united Castile and Aragon in 1492.
That's what Taylor from Antelope Hill said, called the Reconquista, they took back the Iberian Peninsula from the Muslims.
Folks, I'm going to promise you that we are going to have Bill in Puerto Rico on more often. This is the first appearance of many to come, because it's a fascinating, fascinating thing here. There's so much more that we could have gotten into tonight. We could have gone a full hour with you, Bill, but you said that people in Latin America don't see race the way Americans see so-called Hispanics. That's an artificial term, that it is more classist, and that the upper caste strive to be white. We're about to have music. Elaborate on that very quickly.
Very quickly, it is a color continuum. It is not a strict color barrier. The term Hispanic is an artificial creation created by the United States government, solely by the United States government. You're talking about 30 different countries, different cultures. Some of them are more Amerindian-based. Some of them are more mulatto-based in the Caribbean, and so forth. Argentina and Uruguay are more European than the United States. Chile, too, to a very large degree. So Hispanic is just an artificial creation used by the United States government.
And you think, Bill, you think that if one day current trends persist and Hispanics become the predominant majority, that they're not going to put up with black shenanigans? Do you believe that?
Yeah, I do believe that, but they don't have the guilt that Anglo whites have. They just don't have that same kind of guilt. They don't hate the larger society in the same way. They want to adapt to this.
That was the gaslighting I talked about before.
Whatever the reason, it does exist. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You also had some very good takeaways and some points on AOC as she presents herself as this poor Latino woman from the hood, when in fact it was anything but that. She came from a very upper class.
She's well-to-do. She went to Boston University. Come on. She grew up wealthy.
All right. Our march around the world has officially ended in Puerto Rico, of all places you didn't expect. But I tell you what, we couldn't have ended it any better. Fantastic hour with Taylor Young and our correspondent here in Puerto Rico.
Our man, not from Havana, but from San Juan.
And we have a fantastic, fantastic members of our family from Brazil, all around the world.
Now, officially, our man from San Juan.
We'll be back at third hour with an Easter message. Thank you, Bill.